That Clinton would be accused of trying to divert attention from the Lewinsky scandal surprised no one in the policy loop. When the principals met in the White House Situation Room to approve the operation, Secretary of Defense William Cohen said that the president was going to be criticized for trying to change the subject from the ongoing scandal. Others in the room were somewhat surprised that Cohen felt this needed to be spelled out, and no one commented on the remark. Later, when Clinton was briefed on the operation in the cabinet room, one advisor said that there were certain to be allegations that he was trying to distract the country. "If I have to take more criticism for this, I will," he replied. For a shrewd manipulator, Clinton certainly took a battering. In fact, one of the supreme ironies of the episode is that the press accounts were so uniformly negative that Clinton himself came to wonder whether the strike was justified. He eventually asked the NSC for a review of all the intelligence on which the decision to strike was based. Those who worked on the memo, which took months of painstaking effort, concluded that the call was right. Additional information gathered after August 20th, they felt, made the justification for the strike even stronger. Clinton himself had been speaking frequently about terrorism for some time. After the June 1996 Khobar Towers bombing, the United States had insisted on short notice that the agenda for the July meeting of the G7 be scrapped and an emergency session on international cooperation to combat terrorism be held. The president gave a major speech on the subject in early August 1996 at George Washington University, and afterward, his speechwriters had a standing order to include warnings about the rising threat of terror in virtually every foreign policy speech he gave. These were not just perfunctory mentions. Clinton devoted a significant portion of his public speaking on foreign policy to the issue, including his 1998 commencement address at the U.S. Naval Academy. One service academy each year typically gets a presidential graduation visit, and it is the occasion for a major foreign and security policy statement. Thus, 3 months before the East Africa bombings, Clinton spoke about the task of reorganizing the government to meet the terrorist threat and the growing danger of terrorism involving weapons of mass destruction and cyber attacks. A month after the bombings, he focused his annual address to the UN General Assembly on the issue, warning that it is a grave misconception to see terrorism as only, or even mostly, an American problem. Indeed, it is a clear and present danger to tolerant and open societies and innocent people everywhere. No one in this room, nor the people you represent, are immune. During the months while impeachment was hanging in the balance, Clinton did not grant newspaper interviews because of the proceedings, but afterward he gave his first interview to the New York Times' Judith Miller to discuss the threat of terrorist attack with biological weapons, which of all the different strands within the issue was the one he cared about most deeply. Whether anyone saw Clinton's efforts as more than an attempt to change the subject is impossible to judge, but they certainly made little impact on reporters. He continued speaking about terrorism, and it became a personal preoccupation. When Clinton gave his final State of the Union address in January 2000, he added, out of the blue, an improvised aside. "I predict to you, when most of us are long gone, but sometime in the next 10 to 20 years, the major security threat this country will face will come from the enemies of the nation-state. The narco-traffickers and the terrorists and the organized criminals who will be organized together, working together, with increasing access to ever more sophisticated chemical and biological weapons." His timing was wrong. The point was right. NSC officials, ourselves among them, also tried to convince those who would listen that bin Laden was a different kind of terrorist, uniquely dangerous, and that militant Islam posed a growing, serious threat. In the months after the 1998 embassy bombings, this was done in keeping with White House practice, without attribution by name. Time and again we spoke with journalists and tried to impress on them that Al-Qaeda presented a genuine threat to American national security. At a time when it would have been easy to join the masses of government officials who were decrying the bombing of Al-Shifa, we and others maintained in conversation after conversation that targeting the plant was the right thing to do. When one of us was asked over lunch by the foreign editor of the Washington Post what the most important story was that the press was missing, the answer given was the rise of radical Islam, especially in South Asia. After we left the NSC in late 1999 and could speak and write publicly, we tried to sound the alarm. On the New York Times op-ed page on January 4, 2000, we argued that after the terror-free millennium celebrations, some may have decided that Washington had hyped the prospect of an attack by Osama bin Laden and his allies beyond reason. But that conclusion is wrong. The danger posed by Mr. bin Laden and like-minded radical Islamists will not fade. These terrorists are highly motivated, not by a cult of personality, but by a worldview in which they are the vanguard of a divinely ordained battle to liberate Muslim lands. The terrorists allied with Mr. bin Laden do not want a place at the negotiating table. They want to shatter the table. They are not constrained by secular political concerns. Their objective is not to influence, but to kill, and in large numbers. Hence their declared interest in acquiring chemical and even nuclear weapons. Our arguments were rejected by the scholarly establishment and largely ignored by everyone else, in part because the picture we drew of a new breed of terrorist represented such a departure from the commonly held understandings.